This is Focus, our morning talk show. My name's David Inge. Glad to have you with us. Harriet Williamson is the producer for the program. Jason Croft is at the controls this hour. Kyle Mabry was on for hour number one. It's been 100 years since the publication of Peter and Wendy, the novel that introduced much of the world to the character of Peter Pan. In the years since, countless stage productions and novels and movies have told the story of the boy who never grew up. How do we explain his enduring hold on our imagination? In this hour, that is our topic as we talk with Maria Tatar. She's chair of the program in folklore and mythology at Harvard University, where she teaches courses in German studies, folklore, and children's literature. She's the author of a recently published book that we'll be talking about. The title of the book is The Annotated Peter Pan. It's published by W.W. Norton and explores the many different treatments of the story and also traces them back to the real life of Peter's creator, J.M. Barrie. We're talking with her on the telephone this morning, and we'd be very happy to have people who are listening be a part of the conversation. All you need to do is dial the number here in Champaign-Urbana, 333-9455. We do also have a toll-free line, so if it would be a long-distance call, you may use that number, and that's 800-222-9455. You can also send us an email if you'd like to do it that way, and that is will-talk@illinois.edu. So at any point here, people who are listening can participate in the conversation, and we would be very happy to have you do that. And Professor Tatar, hello.
Hello.
Thanks very much for talking with us.
Oh, thanks for inviting me.
We certainly appreciate it. You know, this book, this story, I think we think of as a children's story. Although, and I'm happy through your book, The Annotated Peter Pan, to have been introduced to this novel, Peter and Wendy, because I think I had really known it. I had known it from the musical from 1954, and I had known it from the animated version that Walt Disney created. And the novel is very interesting for a variety of reasons. But I guess what I was going for is the idea that what we think of it as a children's story, there are themes that I think adults can relate to. So the question is, who did J.M. Barrie think he was writing this for?
Well, J.M. Barrie himself was, as he described himself, a betwixt and between. I think it's very clear that he was creating a contact zone for adults and children. He himself suffered somewhat from the Peter Pan complex, that is, he did not want to grow up. So he writes both as a grown man, but also as someone who's really in touch with his childhood and can go back.
Mm. That's you. I know that you certainly did not set out to write a biography of J.M. Barrie, but you can't talk about Peter Pan without talking about Barrie and his life, because those two things are so tangled up with one another.
You're exactly right. And there is something about Barrie's life and the whole backstory of Peter Pan that I think makes the novel even richer. Hmm. I did not set out to write a biography, but I did have to face 19 linear feet of archival materials at the Beinecke Library in New Haven. And so I couldn't help but get deeply immersed in his life and in all its complexities.
Yeah. Perhaps one thing that that people would need to know, and it seems to be something that had a profound impact on him and his family, was the death of a brother, an older brother. I think Barrie was only 7, and this brother was 12. He was killed in an ice skating accident. It severely traumatized his mother. I don't know if she ever really recovered from that loss. And it seemed that in a number of very important ways, you can see the seeds of Peter Pan in this event that occurred when Barrie was just a boy.
That's right. And David was, his older brother, was the boy who would never grow up. So in many ways, he can be seen as the inspiration for Peter Pan.
Then also it's interesting that in his mother, when David died, when her son David died, was very obviously very depressed, understandably very depressed, withdrawn for some period of time. And James, J.M., really, he did things to try to draw his mother out, to try to connect with her, and it involved apparently a lot of story, making up of stories, telling stories. There you can perhaps also see where the seeds of Barry's career as a writer were.
Oh, absolutely, and as a performer as well. So Barry was faced with the loss not only of his older brother David, who was a role model for him, but then the loss of his mother. She retreated into her bedroom for a full year, holding on to David's christening gown. And the way that Barry brought her back was to perform David, basically, to impersonate him. And he became his older brother. And so that theatrical quality to his childhood carried over into real life. He once remarked that literature was his life, that is, creating fiction and fantasy.
And did his mother actually say something like, as her way of perhaps trying to take some comfort from this horrible tragedy, did she actually say something like that, for David, the child that she lost, son that she lost, that he would never grow up, and that somehow there was something that she took some comfort from that?
I'm not sure that she actually used those words, but Barry, I think, had that sense that, you know, he had a brother whom he would never see become an adult. So that particular tragedy marked both of them. The remarkable thing is Barry then went on to write a biography, not of his brother, but of his mother. And she was a rather undistinguished woman, a housekeeper all her life. But he was quite attached to her. And he told her at one point that she appeared in every single play that he ever wrote. Most famously, I think, in Peter Pan as Wendy, the domestic expert who sews and tells stories.
That's interesting that it should be, although perhaps not surprising, that in a sense that it's Wendy is the ideal woman that connects with his mother, and that it would not so much be the mother in the play, Mrs. Darling, but that in fact it really that it's Wendy in the play that's his mother.
And the most important character, yes.
You know, the first line of the novel, the much quoted, I'm sure, first line of the novel, Peter and Wendy, is all children except one grow up. And apparently much later in life, sometime after having written that, Barry said that he finally came to realize what Peter Pan meant to his own life story. And I find myself wondering about that, whether in fact he really didn't understand that, and did it take so much time and so much introspection for him to realize where Peter Pan came from?
Yes, that first sentence is really the gift of the perfect opening. And Barry later wasn't really aware of when he had written down the play Peter Pan. He remarks on that in the introduction to the work. And he jokes around and speculates on the possibility of different authors. But there is something about an unconscious process going on. This is really primary process, primal material that he puts on paper.
Let me just very quickly introduce again our guest, Maria Tatar. She is a professor at Harvard University, where she teaches courses on literature and folklore. She has authored a number of these annotated works, like the one that we're talking about here, the annotated Brothers Grimm, Classic Fairy Tales, Hans Christian Andersen, and then the new book, which is recently out, the annotated Peter Pan, the Centennial Edition, refers to the fact that this novel, Peter and Wendy, was published in 1911, in October of 1911. The book is just out from W.W. Norton, and it's a lovely book. You might want to take a look at it. Questions are welcome to 333-9455 and toll-free 800-222-9455. The character, it gets sort of confusing here because it was a novel, but before that it was a play, and then you even have to take a step back, and that this character, the Peter, does indeed appear in an even earlier book which was a novel and not a children's book. The Little White Bird. What is The Little White Bird about?
The Little White Bird is about a writer and his relationship to a boy in the neighborhood. The writer then tells the boy stories about Peter Pan and Kensington Gardens, and those chapters were later excerpted as a book for adults and children with wonderful illustrations by Arthur Rackham, which I was fortunately able to include in the annotated Peter Pan. There are so many different versions of Peter Pan, and not just many versions that Barry created, but as you pointed out earlier, in our culture, he's constantly being recycled, reimagined, refashioned. Mm. And the very earliest version is actually a photo album that Barry created while he was playing pirates with five boys whom he later adopted. And it was from those adventures that the story of Neverland came to be.
And there we have to talk about this family that he came to know, and it has this unusual and some people, I guess, find troubling, or at least they're not really sure what to make of it, with his relationship with the children of Arthur and Sylvia Llewellyn Davies. Apparently the story is that J.M. Barrie lived very near this grand park, Kensington Gardens in London, and would go there and would walk, and he had a big St. Bernard, which I'm sure attracted a lot of attention, and he met these...
Especially when he danced with it.
Yes, indeed, which, people will remember seeing that the movie loosely adapted on his life with Johnny Depp, and he actually does indeed dance with the dog. So I'm sure that it attracted a lot of attention, and so he met these little boys and struck up a relationship with them. In fact, he knew the boys before he knew the parents.
That's right, and he told them stories in Kensington Gardens. One evening he went to a dinner party and met Sylvia Llewellyn Davies, and I think instantly fell in love with her. He was, in a way, in love with the boys, too, and telling stories, playing with the dog, playing games in Kensington Gardens was his way of going back as well. Tragically, both parents of the Llewellyn Davies boys died. Arthur died. Arthur was a successful barrister. He died of cancer of the jaw. Sylvia died a year later of stomach cancer. And Barry adopted all five boys and educated them, put them through school, spent his summer vacations with them, and in a way overcame his own Peter Pan complex by becoming a father.
Mm-hmm. And this is, I suppose, the point where people, one of the places where people raise questions about what it was that was motivating him, and was he, to put it bluntly, a sexual predator, and had that kind of interest in these little boys? And at least from what you've been able to find by looking back through whatever paper trail has been left from the people that were part of this relationship, is that it seems not to have been the case. At least there's no one talks about anything untoward having happened.
Yes, Barry's sexuality will always remain a mystery to us. He once described himself as a house with shutters. He was Scottish, and he believed that he was an introvert. There's no doubt that he was repressed in many ways. We don't know exactly what his orientation was. He was certainly not a predator, and the boys themselves wrote about, even in his own time, there were some suspicions, some eyebrows raised about his relationship to the boys, but they are quite eloquent in defending him. They know that he's a little odd, there's no doubt about that, but he always treated them as a father and as a generous guardian.
And at the time that he met the boys and he met and really became enamored of Sylvia Llewellyn Davies, Barry was married, but he and his wife did not have any children. And there, I guess, was some speculation, continues to be some speculation, that in fact he and his wife never had marital relations.
Yes, the A divorce was rather public, something of a scandal in London. Mary Ansell was a beautiful, talented actress. She did want to have children. And after the divorce, she reported to friends that the marriage had never been consummated. And they were married for quite a few years. It's rather sad to read her reminiscences because she found her own life in gardening and also in raising the various dogs in the household. And she reports that sometimes she counted on the dogs for company at supper time because Barry was so shuttered up.
Yeah, I think isn't there a story about where she writes about the silent dinners that the two of them would have
right.
together, and the fact that though that the dog was there, and that gave them something to focus on and something to smile about, and it sounds terribly sad the way that she tells the story, but that was something that actually saved them from maybe absolute despair.
Certainly saved her. I think he was a writer, and I think that sometimes those silences were very productive for him in thinking about a new play, new lines, or something like that. But she was an actress and expressive, so it was more of a challenge for her to deal with silence.
And so she clearly wanted to have children, and it looks like Barry wanted to have children. He took these children on. He eventually, as you say, when the parents died, he adopted them and really became their father. So it seems puzzling and sad that somehow he and his wife, who seem both to want to have a family, for some reason, which, as you say, I suppose would never really completely understand, just it didn't happen for them. It couldn't happen for them,
right.
Apparently.
Yes, and Barry adopted the five boys, but then he also created what he called a dream child in Peter Pan. Lewis Carroll also saw Alice as his dream child. You have many authors of children's books who see the characters that they've written about as kind of substitute children that they create and allow to navigate a fictional world.
Well, we have a caller here, and certainly others who are listening would be welcome to call. If you have questions, comments, you'd like to talk with our guest, Maria Tatar, the number here in Champaign-Urbana, 333-9455, and toll-free, 800-222-9455. We have somebody here on cell phone on our line number 4. We'll go right to them. Hello.
Yeah, hi, David. Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
Very interesting. I had no idea of the background of the author, and now that it's being discussed, the parallels come out very clearly. Just a couple of comments, and I'll ring off. I'm in my mid-50s, and back in the day, I can remember the TV program, Mary Martin, being quite an event at our house, almost equal to when The Wizard of Oz would come on. Because back in those days, TV and those kinds of productions were really something, and were not on all the time. So if you missed it, that was it. But I was wondering if you touched on this. Forgive me, but I was wondering if your guest could. Were there any parallels with the author and with the pirates that played in the Peter Pan? I was wondering if there were any sort of relationships that he drew on for that side of the story. And I'll go ahead and listen off air. Thanks.
All right. Thank you.
Oh, where did those pirates come from? They came from the adventure stories that that Barry read as a boy. He loved Treasure Island, and he established a correspondence with Stevenson. He hoped to meet him, but Stevenson died before Barry could get to Samoa to visit him. As a boy, Barry was a voracious reader, and at one point he heard a minister blast the kinds of stories that he had been reading, and he buried all of his pirate stories, all those imperialist adventure stories. So that's where the pirates came from. And when Barry played those pirate games with the Llewellyn Davies boys, he was, at that time, Captain Swarthy. The name Hook had not yet come into his mind, but there he was playing the pirate.
I'm sure that probably a lot of people, I would say, you know, myself included, that's that we, our introduction to Peter Pan was when that production of that musical that I believe it was 1954, the musical premiered and really made, I think, made a big star out of Mary Martin, and it was done on television. And since there have been a number of other television productions and Broadway productions with other actresses, I think that probably for a lot of people that was their first meeting with Peter Pan.
Yes, and so interesting that Peter Pan is played by a woman, that in the tradition of the theater, it was Nina Boucicault who first played Peter Pan. And Maude Adams in the United States, they made the role famous. And Mary, I remember seeing the Mary Martin performance and being, I think I was about 8 years old at the time, and finding it so unsettling to discover that Peter Pan was played by a grown woman. Even though now I look at the musical and I think, well, she looks quite young and boyish. Mm-hmm. For a child, it was somehow difficult, especially because I had read Peter Pan. I loved the figure, and it felt wrong to have a woman on stage, but I think I'm in a minority there.
Well, I don't, you know, it's funny because my wife also tells the story of watching that television show as a little girl and talks about how her mother says to her, well, you know, Peter Pan's a girl. And my wife, I think for my wife, this was something akin to being told there was no Santa Claus. And she felt very, very disillusioned and very upset that with that news, first of all, and that her mother felt that she had to break that to her, that in fact, no, that person that you're seeing there, that is a girl.
And Bruce Hansen has written a wonderful theatrical history of Peter Pan. And one of the things that you discover is that, first of all, in their earliest performance in 1904, they created flying harnesses. Barry actually hired someone to manage the technology. And there were many accidents. The actors had to take out life insurance policies. They got quite worried when they had to sign on the dotted line. And Mary Martin herself had several quite serious accidents on stage.
Well, this is sort of puts you in mind of the stories that were told about the recent Spider-Man musical that got so much attention in New York, where some people were really seriously injured when they were trying to figure out how to make the characters fly.
Right.
Well, another, I'm also, there was a story that I think is really interesting that before the play was to premiere, the Peter Pan, the producers, they were really concerned with how the audience was going to react. And particularly at that famous point when Tinkerbell drinks the poison intended for Peter, and Peter turns to the audience and says, well, you can save her life if everybody who believes in fairies will clap. And they thought, and they didn't know what the audience would do. And apparently they actually told the orchestra, said, look, you guys, you got to be prepared to clap and clap real loud, because we don't know if the audience is going to go with this. And apparently the audience did, in wildly, and this was an adult audience that we're talking about here.
Yes, they clapped enthusiastically, and it was a huge risk. In fact, Charles Frohman, who took on production of the play, was told by many people that Barry was absolutely mad, and that the script for this play was just preposterous. Frohman, fortunately, found the play to be just enchanting. He would stop people on the streets and describe the fantasy of Peter Pan to them. So he backed the play. He backed Barry. Barry even gave him a second drama, Alice Sit by the Fire, which I think had something like a dozen performances, with a hope that he could make up for the losses on Peter Pan with Alice Sit by the Fire. And, of course, the irony of that is just wonderful. Frohman was thrilled, and the play was a huge success and has run continuously, except during the war years, during the First World War in London, and obviously all over the world as well.
Mm-hmm. And I suppose as people know Barry as the creator of Peter Pan for the novel, for the play, he actually, even before Peter Pan, was quite a successful writer, and in addition to Peter Pan, wrote a lot for the stage.
Yes, he was hugely successful. And this was the era of theater. There was greater mobility in London. People could actually come into the city for the evening to see a play. So it was the golden age of theater. And Barry was hugely successful as a dramatist, made heaps of money, but was very careless and made a habit. He finally hired a personal secretary, but he used to just put the checks into drawers and forget about them. And so he himself was not ambitious in financial terms. He was ambitious as a playwright. He loved the theater. He went to dress rehearsals. He changed the play. This is one of the reasons why Peter Pan, the play, was not really written down fully until 1928. It went through so many different versions. The actors were constantly improvising. Barry sometimes would be writing new scenes a day before the performance.
Hmm. And I gather that one of the things that changed the most was the end.
That's right, yes. We don't have the mothers, the beautiful mothers, who adopt the lost boys in our versions of Peter Pan. And sometimes we have the sequel, which is added, where we learn about Jane and Margaret, who go to Neverland to help Peter with his spring cleaning. There's that wonderful last chapter of Peter and Wendy called When Wendy Grew Up, mm-hmm. which describes the flow of generations. And also the tragedy of, you know, Peter Pan has no memory. He may never grow up. He may be forever young. But he's not able to remember things from one moment to the next, which explains why he's constantly infatuated with new people, with new adventures. When he comes to visit Wendy, he's not quite sure who she is, and he's perfectly happy to go off with Jane and with Margaret.
Her daughter and then her granddaughter.
Granddaughter, yeah.
And isn't there also, at some point, just the littlest hint that actually Wendy's mother, Mrs. Darling, actually knows Peter?
That's right, yes. She and her mother before. So there's this constant, this return of the same. Just as in Neverland, there's a kind of repetitive quality because the so-called Redskins and the pirates and the Lost Boys are constantly chasing themselves around the island in a circle, experiencing what the narrator tells us are ecstasies innumerable, all of these wonderful adventures.
Yeah. We're talking this morning in this hour of focus with Maria Tatar, and we're talking about Peter Pan. She's written about J.M. Barrie, the creator, where this story comes from, how it's been changed and performed for so long, all of this in her new book, Peter Pan, the Centennial Edition, the annotated Peter Pan, the Centennial Edition. We'll talk some more after a short break. This is Focus.
David Coleman Headley was one of the leaders of the terrorist attack on Mumbai. The son of a Pakistani father and American mother, Headley became a drug smuggler, then a DEA informant, and after 9/11, an Islamic militant while working for the DEA. On the next Fresh Air, we speak with investigative reporter Sebastian Rotella about his new Frontline documentary. Join us.
This afternoon at 1 and this evening at 7 on AM 580.
Support comes from The Music Shop, celebrating 50 years of service to music education, providing for musicians of all ages in over 200 school music programs. They also feature guitars, amplifiers, digital pianos, and sound equipment in the Pro Sound Center at 27 East Market View Drive in Market View Plaza, Champaign, or at themusicshop.com.
This is Focus, our morning talk program. My name's David Inge. Glad to have you with us. We're here weekday mornings with 10 different topics for you every week. Tomorrow morning in the 10 o'clock hour, our guest will be William Arkin. He's an investigative journalist and columnist with The Washington Post. And we'll be talking about a book that he has co-authored. The title is Top Secret America, The Rise of the New American Security State. And it is all about the growth in the American security apparatus that occurred after 9/11. And tries to ask and answer the question, as a result, are we more safe? And he and his co-author, Dana Priest, argued, no, we're actually not more safe. That'll be tomorrow in the 10 o'clock hour. And then at 11 o'clock, Celeste Quinn will be here in the host chair talking about the fall veto session of the Illinois legislature and some of the issues that have been decided or have not been decided. And she'll have two guests, Christopher Mooney, who teaches political studies at the University of Illinois Springfield, and also Brian Gaines, who is a professor of political science here at U of I Urbana-Champaign. That's tomorrow. We're here weekday mornings from 10 until noon. You can check up on the schedule, listen to past programs by going to our website. That's WILL.illinois.edu. The guest in this hour of focus is Maria Tatar. She is a professor at Harvard, where she teaches courses on literature and folklore, and she has authored a number of books about folktales, fairy tales, several books that are kind of like the one we're talking about this morning, the annotated Peter Pan. That's the one that's just out from Norton. She's also done the annotated Brothers Grimm, classic fairy tales, and Hans Christian Andersen. And questions are welcome. 333-9455, toll-free 800-222-9455. Well, you're a folklorist, and one of the things that folklorists do is they collect and they study stories that people tell, and they look for commonalities among different people. And certainly there are a lot of stories about young people leaving home, going on an adventure, being changed in the process. I guess Peter doesn't really change, but are there other ways in which you think this story of Peter Pan does indeed connect to other existing stories that people tell?
Yes, well, Peter Pan himself is a kind of mythical figure. He is related to the god of nature, and he's a sort of Hermes, a kind of trickster figure. So he has a mythical quality. And I think that he's taken on the status of an iconic character who's just changing all the time and, as I mentioned earlier, reinvented by us. It's the darling children who follow the paradigm of the classic children's story. Mm-hmm. That is, what do? They leave the nursery. But the great thing about Peter Pan is that they fly off. They fly away. Children don't have that kind of mobility. And I always think back to my childhood, where the most powerful fantasy I think that I had was being able to take off, to be above it all, to look down on everyone, to have that kind of power to move, a lack of gravity, all those things. That said, I remember talking to one woman who had read Peter Pan as a child and who was terrified by it because she saw Peter Pan as a figure who was taking the children away to the land of the dead, and that if you went to Neverland, you would die. You would no longer live in the real world. Obviously, that doesn't happen. The children go and have adventures, and then in classic fashion, like Dorothy or like the children in Narnia, they return back home again.
Yeah. Well, you know, I think that's an interesting angle and one I wanted to pursue because as people will probably will remember, they know the story, Peter persuades Wendy to come with him back to Neverland to be a mother to his posse, you know, his guys, the Lost Boys, who were children who were lost in Kensington Gardens. I love this part of the story. Apparently, these were babies that fell out of their prams when their nannies weren't looking.
That's right. And Peter kidnaps them. He's almost like a Pied Piper figure, quite dangerous. He ferries them off to Neverland. So I thought that reader actually was quite shrewd as a child in understanding that Neverland was, in fact, in some ways connected to the land of the dead. And Peter is a kind of Charon figure who is ferrying the children there. And remember, Peter also says to die will be an awfully big adventure. He is dressed at the beginning in skeleton leaves. And what has he lost but his shadow? So while there's a bright side to him, and while there are a million golden arrows, as Barry tells us, pointing to Neverland, there's also something scary and dangerous and perilous about Neverland.
And that's something that I would expect, you know, reading this as a grown-up, as I am now, not a parent, but I can imagine how an adult with children might look at this because the lost boys, you know, you really wonder, what, indeed, does lost mean dead? And this is one of the great parental fears, you know.
Right, losing a child. Yeah. And so definitely that term has an edge to it. We forget sometimes, I think, how much children's books engage with anxieties about mortality. There's Charlotte's Web, which is, you know, it begins with, where's Papa going with that axe? To Wilbur's words, I don't want to die. Mm-hmm. He actually says that. But you can find it in almost any children's books, the perils, the risks, the brushes with death. And children need that. They, you know, want bright and sunny things and fantasy and humor and imagination. But they also read because they're curious about adult matters. And I think it was Barry's genius to create a book that could be read in one way as a child, with some understanding of the perils of Neverland, and then another way as an adult.
I also think that it's wonderful that Wendy, I think she says to Peter something like, well, why are there no lost girls? And Peter says it's because they're too smart to fall out of their prams.
There are interesting gender configurations in Neverland, and I think it's fascinating that Peter wants Wendy there so that she will tell stories. That is something that he's incapable of doing because he has no memory and no cultural memory at all. Hmm. And what story does she tell but Cinderella? She brings fairy tales into Neverland, a really wonderful touch, I think.
Yeah. Another aspect of this that I really find quite fascinating is that it goes to the nature of Peter, which I suppose... This I'm being an amateur analyst now, but also makes me think of J.M. Barrie, is that Peter is a, well, at the same time there are these connections with this Randy god, Pan, Peter is really, is not sexual, he's pre-sexual, and he takes Wendy off not to be his girlfriend, but to be his mother. And at the same time, though, it seems that the characters in this that are the most sexually charged are the women in the story.
Yes, Wendy does not really want to be a mother. All the girls in Neverland are pursuing Peter, and yet Peter, as Barry tells us in the stage directions to the play, he can never be touched. And I think Barry meant that very clearly in the double sense of the term. Mm. That is, he can't be physically touched by any of the young women, and he also can't be emotionally moved. So the girls are always flirting with him and trying to become his favorite. And he's completely uninterested in romance.
Yeah, I'm sure, again, we'll remember the famous tension in the relationship between Wendy and Tinkerbell.
Yes, right. The sexual rivalry there.
Yeah.
And Tiger Lily as well. That is, the three of them are involved in this tango about Peter.
We have some other callers here. Let's get them in Champagne next, line number one. Hello.
Hello.
Yes.
I remember as a child going to a performance in Chicago of Max Reinhardt's A Midsummer Night's Dream. And as I recall, Peter Pan was very much a part of that. Performance. Anyway, I wonder if you could talk a little about that. Thank you.
Okay. Well, certainly you can in the figure of Puck, who appears in Midsummer Night's Dream. There seems to be some connection. I think you could see connection between Peter and Puck.
I think that's exactly what your caller is referring to. These mischievous, adventurous sprites and spirits. And they do appear in folklore, in, you know, every part of the world. And it's interesting to me that Disney always has mischievous boys. That is, he made Peter Pan and Pinocchio. both of these stories about boys who are looking for adventure. And when you survey the fairy tale heroines, they're really quite different. They're in search of romance.
Hmm. All right, let's talk with someone in next in Monticello, line number two. Hello.
Hi.
Yeah.
I wanted to ask the author if there are many books that are out there that are like parodies of Peter Pan. I know, for instance, there's a book by Andrea Jones called Hook and Jill, and there was talk about a book about Tinkerbell, but I haven't heard anything more about that, and I'll listen offline.
Okay.
Well, Disney has created a new franchise with the Tinkerbell films, and it's fascinating to me that she has become a more important character for Disney Studios. And then, of course, there's Dave Barry's and Ridley Pearson's Peter and the Starcatchers, that entire series, which is great fun, and lots of other prequels and sequels. Speaking of lost girls, there actually are some lost girls in Jane Yolen's story of that title.
All right. Other questions are welcome. We have maybe about 6-7 minutes left in this part of Focus. Our guest is Maria Tatar. She is a professor of the humanities at Harvard University. She teaches courses there on literature and folklore. And she is the author of this newly published book, The Annotated Peter Pan, the Centennial Edition. And it's truly a wonderful book. I'm sure many folks would enjoy it. A lot of wonderful illustrations. And the novel there, this original novel that was published in 1911, the text is there with illustrations from the Scribner's 1911 edition. That was the one that was people saw here in the United States. It's a really lovely book. You might want to take a look at it. And questions here, welcome, 333-9455, toll-free 800-222-9455. And there's also the possibility of email if you'd like to send us a thought that way, will-talk@illinois.edu. Something else that is a curious thing to think about. In the plays, traditionally, the same actor has played Captain Hook and Mr. Darling, so has been both the dad and the pirate. So that invites you to start thinking about this, to what extent Barry was thinking about father-son conflicts as being a theme that he wanted to play with. Or is that something that just comes to us, comes to us because of Freud and other thinkers, and we're bringing stuff along that Barry never had in mind?
Not at all. We do know that Barry was obsessed with his mother, and here he is writing about father figures. Mr. Darling, who is something of a buffoon, he's the one who won't take his medicine, and he acts like a child more than anything else. He's not a figure of authority by any stretch of the imagination. And then we have the other father figure. You remember Peter is referred to as a dark and insolent youth. That's what Hook calls him, or proud and insolent youth. And Peter counters by saying dark and sinister man. So there's this generational conflict there. Hook also is a buffoon in certain ways. He's described as an effeminate pirate. He has these interesting curls. Sometimes he smokes two cigars at one time. And he's a firm believer in what he calls good form. Mm. That is, there's an odd pedantic quality to him. And originally, the villain of The Boy Castaways of Black Lake Island, the first version of Peter Pan, featured a school teacher as villain. So the character went from being a school teacher to a pirate.
Hmm. But in a sense, it's kind of an adult authority figure, and I suppose it goes back to this, you know, this thing of having to assume the adult role, and Peter's certainly chafing, and maybe Barry's in some part of him it also chafes too about that idea that you do have to grow up into this thing, this adult man, and that you have to behave in certain ways. And
and also, they're the ones who are terrified of death, because, after all, it's Hook who is being chased by the crocodile, which has a clock ticking inside of it. So the real fear of mortality is incarnated in Captain Hook.
Yeah.
But it's fascinating to me that both of them should be sort of figures of authority, and yet they turn out to be comic characters more than anything else. Their authority is undermined constantly.
And Peter himself, you know, as you say, Captain Hook is, he's being stalked by death, and the fear of death is always with him. Peter is fearless. He's not afraid of anything.
And he's triumphant, and he crows. He's the one, I think, who inspired the figure of Mickey in Sendak's In the Night Kitchen. And so he's wonderfully unafraid and willing to face the dark and sinister captain.
Hmm. We talked a little bit earlier about this this interesting relationship that he had, that J.M. Barrie had with this family and with the children, and how he truly seemed to be in love in a kind of platonic way with the mother, Sylvia Llewellyn Davies, and she and her husband, first the husband, they both died of cancer. First the husband died, and then not long after that, Sylvia died, and then he ended up adopting the boys and really becoming their father. But you wonder how exactly the boys, when they were adults, felt about this. Now, one was killed in World War I, and another died in an accidental drowning, I think. But Peter Llewellyn Davies, who gave his name to Peter Pan, did indeed grow up to be a grown up and have something to say about how he felt about, in a sense, being Peter Pan, and he seemed not to be all that happy about it.
He referred to Peter Pan as that terrible masterpiece. There was so much tragedy in the lives of these boys. That is, you mentioned George, who was struck by a stray bullet on the front in World War I, and then Michael's suicide. Here he was, this promising young man. He wrote poetry. He was quite successful at school, and he drowns while at Oxford. And then Peter Llewellyn Davies does grow up. He suffers because of this terrible masterpiece. And then in London, he throws himself under a subway train. This is in his later years, and at a time when his wife was suffering from a fatal disease, and he himself was clinically depressed. And so we don't know exactly what all of the factors were, but surely those factors contributed to his suicide.
Mm.
So it's just a heart-wrenching ending to the story of Peter Pan.
I wonder if there was something going on here with Peter Llewellyn Davies, perhaps feeling that he should have been entitled to some kind of recompense, in a sense, for what this connection did to his life, and was quite disappointed that when J.M. Barrie died, and he had accumulated some significant wealth because of his success, didn't leave much to the boys. That the bulk of his fortune, including however much money Peter Pan earned, went to a large children's hospital in London.
The Great Ormond Street Hospital for Children, which continues to benefit from the royalties for Peter Pan. So this was really a great good thing that Barrie did. The remainder of his estate, though, was divided among the boys and also with his personal secretary, who received the bulk of the estate.
Hmm.
Now, Peter was well established as a publisher, and Barrie had helped him to develop that firm. So I think, you know, he was actually taken care of. Yes, there was some bitterness that he had not inherited more, but I don't think anyone ever quarreled with the idea that the royalties for the great for Peter Pan would go to the hospital for children. That seemed to be exactly right. And in fact, I'm sharing the royalties for this book with the hospital. even though, I mean, there is, one could argue that Peter Pan is in the public domain at this point, but there's some very complicated legislation in Great Britain about the rights for Peter Pan. And I think the hospital certainly deserves to continue receiving the royalties.
Mm-hmm. Well, we're coming down to the point where we have about a minute or so left. I guess I would say that I'm through your book, I was really pleased to be introduced to the novel, because I think there was a lot in that book that a grown-up can relate to. In fact, I think there's a lot in that book that probably wouldn't strike them the way that it would if you were a grown-up reading it. And I think it's a nice little piece of writing. And I guess I would just encourage people, if all you know is Peter Pan, is from Mary Martin and that musical, or from Walt Disney, I would encourage them to take a look at the novel that he took from the story that had been this play, because I think it's I'm very, very struck by it. And so there's so much in it that I think is really very touching. That, again, as I say, that I think that would a child, unless it was a fairly mature child, wouldn't get it, but an adult would.
It's wonderfully complicated, and that's why I felt that it really was worth annotating, because you can read it just as text and enjoy it, the verbal play, the excitement, the adventures. But then knowing the story behind the story and also getting more of the cultural context makes it all the deeper and more interesting.
Yeah. And it was this at the time, even the I talked about how the many adults certainly attended the performances of the play, would it have been at a time when there wasn't quite the sharp division that we think of now between writing for adults and writing for children?
Certainly Barry, I think, began to bridge that divide. Beginning with Lewis Carroll in the mid-19th century, you have an author who is suddenly creating works that are both for children and for adults. And then today, children's literature has made a tremendous comeback. The New York Times in 2000 had to divide up the bestseller list into children's books and then fiction, mainly because otherwise children's books would have dominated all of the bestseller lists. What are adults reading today? Not just Harry Potter, but also The Hunger Games, Philip Pullman's, His Dark Materials. All of these books seem to have migrated into adult culture as well. So that gap seems to be closing even more today.
All right. Well, it's a wonderful book. I would suggest people look at it, The Annotated Peter Pan, the Centennial Edition, edited with an introduction and notes by our guest Maria Tatar from Harvard. Thanks very much for talking with us.
Thanks for having me.